And, we're going to go on to case number 3, which is appeal number 024222 and 024224, United States of America versus DeVore and Mitrione. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Kathy Pilkington, and I represent Marla DeVore. There are two appellants, Dr. Mitrione and Ms. DeVore. Your Honor, the way we're going to, I've worked this out with my co-counsel.
We see that, five and
five. And five, and there's a statutory argument. Mr. Dawson is going to cover that. I'm going to cover some of the other issues. I'd like to just briefly tell you about the case. It involves Medicaid and Medicare, which I know Your Honors have dealt with before. I have also for many years. And I'd like to just start out with a little quote that I thought was very apropos to this particular case. And this quote was written by Mr. James Madison in 1787. And he said, "It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice, if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood, if they be repealed or revised before they are promulgated, or undergo such incessant changes that no man who knows what the law is today can guess what it will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, but how can that be a rule which is little known and less fixed?" And Mr. Madison made that statement in the Federalist Papers. Number
good 62. Thing he never read the Telecommunications Act.
Well, what he was talking about there is one aspect of what you've got to deal with today. The Medicaid and Medicare laws are a labyrinth of laws for you and for me, much less for the medical and healthcare professionals that have to deal with them and figure them out. This particular case, in addition to that labyrinth of laws, is overlain by the government's contention of billing fraud, the defendant's denial and statement that they did not understand the law, and then overlain with perjury by the auditor from the Illinois Department of Public Aid.
And let me talk about her, because that's what I find the most troubling issue. But the question I have for you is whether her testimony really had any bearing at all on counts 12 and 14, since she didn't testify about substitute billing, and whether you think because of the perjury, the whole, well, I understand it's your position, everything should have been thrown out, but why don't you address that problem I think you have?
Judge Williams, I'm glad you asked that question. That's one of the precise things that I do want to cover with you. First, counts 12 and 14. The question is, what do they really encompass? You said substitute billing. That's not true, and I'll tell you how you know it's not true. Early on in the case, there was a motion for bill of particulars so that the defendants could find out what each of these counts involved. That motion for bill of particulars was denied. However, when the motion for new trial was brought, the government did file a response, and it finally did explain what each of these various counts contain. And if you look in the government's response to the motion for new trial, which I believe is document 187 in the record, it is stated that count 12 involved the unqualified person and substitute billing theories, and count 14 involved upcoding, ghost billing, use of an unqualified person, and substitute billing. So first of all, take a look at what the government said there. I know they're saying something different now in their brief, but if you take a look at their response there, that pretty much lays out what I think those counts, at least what they said at the time, what those counts involved. So that being said, just looking at the substitute billing issue, the answer is absolutely did it affect it. What you have to do is you have to look at what happened over a month-long trial. For everything that the government came up with, the defendants explained. They explained there were errors, there were turnover in billing clerks, etc.
I have to ask you why the defendants didn't look further at the discrepancy between Ms. Statler's data and Parker's data during the trial or before trial. Because during the pretrial conference, the counsel for Ms. DeVore stated that it looked like some of the data included treatment that was given in hospitals. And I'm wondering why nothing was done to investigate the problem at that time.
I can explain that as well, because here is indeed what happened. And again, you're going to find the answer in the government's response to the motion for new trial. They lay it out there. That is indeed the truth. Approximately a week or so before trial, the government handed out an exhibit, which was called Exhibit Number 20A. And I'm going to say that it was roughly an inch thick. And it was a landscape page, and it had data landscaped on the page, basically raw data of what Ms. Statler had done. She had apparently completed it in February. Why the government didn't give it over to the defense until August, I would like to know the answer to that question. However, here's what happened. Mr. Parker testified, and you'll read it right in the government's response. The government states that what happened is after they heard Parker, then Ms. Statler and several other persons did what is called the modified 20A. And they they deleted a bunch of the claims. They took then modified 20A. This was done between September 5th and 6th. The trial started in late August. They took modified 20A, and from modified 20A, from what we heard at the motion for new trial, the results were then given to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor then came up with the chart. So it wasn't that the defense didn't investigate. The defense couldn't investigate because Mr. Parker testified, and then the modified 20A was created. Did I explain it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, thank you for your response.
let's see. Judge Williams, on the substitute billing, I still wanted to explain that. And that is, if you look at the totality of what happened here after trial, what Ms. DeVore was claiming throughout the trial was that there were many errors. She claimed that she started off not knowing how to bill. But Mr. Gary Vaughn from the Illinois Department of Public Aid came out and trained billers. Now, this was a great weakness in the government's case. One of these billers, and they were the government's witnesses, Ms. McGowan and Ms. Lynn Fine, were trained by Mr. Gary Vaughn, and they never knew that you couldn't bill for therapists. What happened when that chart came up on the screen, what it showed was it basically did away with Mr. Parker's explanation. It showed that basically Ms. DeVore was trying to mislead the jury. And all of her explanations about Mr. Vaughn basically were by the wayside. This isn't just false testimony. This is a screen. It's like a big movie screen. And up on that screen, it flashed in the courtroom and remained while the witness testified, a chart that showed a fraud scheme. But you'll note it's at pages 14 and 15 of your appendix. The chart that the prosecutor put together, which, by the way, Ms. Statler claimed at trial, she didn't know who had put that together. Then later on it was admitted that she knew that the prosecutor had put it together. You look at the corrected chart, and it shows exactly the opposite. It substantiates the defense, what Ms. DeVore was saying the whole time. So if you conclude that if the jury believes that she's lying on this, then the jury believes she's lying on that. And so bottom line is, it does affect credibility, absolutely.
What about the impact of the not guilty verdict?
Okay. As far as the not guilty verdict.
As it relates to your last argument.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have Ms. Linda Fine. Ms. Linda Fine had a nervous breakdown. Ms. Linda, two of the counts 7 and 8. That's Ms. Linda Fine. Ms. Linda Fine's testimony was so incredible that the jury didn't believe a word that she said. She said that every time she billed, she had the clinical file right next to her. And that was in contrast to the whole parade of witnesses that had been there. The other two claims were Ms. Sherry McGowan, who was doing the billing at the time, and Ms. Sherry McGowan had signed those forms. Ms. DeVore wasn't billing at the time. And so that is why I believe the jury found not guilty on those counts.
Ms. Pilkington, are the is Ms. DeVore and Dr. Mitrione, are they incarcerated at this time?
No, Your Honor. Judge Scott gave them a bond pending appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Dawson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I represent Dr. Mitrione. I'm going to try and take about 2.5 minutes on two things. I would like to try and give the court a little bit different view on the substitute billing issue before I talk at all about the preemption argument. It's pretty well briefed anyway, but the government now argues to this court that the false testimony only impacted the ghost billing and upcoding counts, and at pages 6 and 42 of their brief, the government says that counts 12 and 14 are exclusively substitute billing. But the way the government argued their evidence from trial tells us a different story, and I think identifies why 12 and 14 should be dismissed as well. It also seems an important omission from the way the government argued their evidence in their brief that they failed to talk about or respond to my mention of what they had said during opening and closing argument. In their opening statement, the government told the jury the evidence was going to show three levels of fraud regarding Walt Woods: not qualified, ghost billing, and substitute billing. So at the time of the opening statement, Walt Woods was not exclusively substitute billing. In the government's closing statement, the government told the jury several things had been proved with respect to Walt Woods. And this is at page 39 of my brief, with cites that he was unqualified, that he that Dr. Mitrione substitute billed for Woods, and that Woods had held group sessions, but they were billed for 45 to 50 minute sessions, and that's upcoding. So in the closing argument, the government is arguing that Walt Woods was, that Dr. Mitrione was upcoding with respect to Walt Woods. And just put this in juxtaposition to their statement now to this court that count 12 and 14 are exclusively substitute billing. It just makes no sense. Even if counts 12 and 14 had been presented to the jury only as substitute billing and qualifications, the counts, I think, should still be dismissed because Statler's testimony, in my view, did impact more than the defense of accidental erroneous billing. The government only now, again, suggests that they fired a rifle shot with 12 and 14, when in fact I think they fired a shotgun. Statler's testimony undermined the defense that the defendant believed he could substitute bill, and he believed Walt Woods was qualified, if as in the briefing, qualifications is an issue anyway. The government used the Statler testimony to demonstrate fraudulent intent and a fraudulent billing scheme on all counts. And if you just would think about what they said, and I think I mentioned it at page 36 of my brief, in their closing, Deanna Statler, you heard from her regarding the percentage, the fact that three times more bills were sent out when no services was provided than otherwise. During final, they also said, we have gone through the billing. Oh, the chart. Is this all there is? No. The public auditor says she looked over hundreds of records and no treatment notes. Benefit paid, 28%. No treatment notes, 9%. Those are the numbers that should matter, not the isolated ones they chose to give to Mr. Parker. They gave him more but chose not to use because the numbers might be different. If you look at all the records, as this public aid auditor did, and you come up with three times more than not billed, accident be kind of weighed a little more evenly if it were accident, wouldn't it? So you see what he did in that context was go really beyond just errors and belly. They were telling the jury that they cheated, the defense cheated by not giving their Parker all of the enough records to make an analysis, because those records might show something different. But in fact, Dr. Parker was simply given the Parker, the expert, was simply given the records from the patients who were listed in the indictment. So the government also used Woods. These things go back and forth between all the counts and an ever-changing fluid group of philosophies of ghost belling, upcoding, substitute belling, qualifications. And if we look at what they said about Woods, oh my gosh.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Okay. Count 12 and 13 deal with Walt Woods. If you needed any more convincing that the defendants were out to defraud, that the defendant's intent was to take money to which they were not entitled, I gave you two words, Walt Woods. As I told you at the beginning, you can't look into other people's minds, you can't see what they're thinking, but boy, their actions sometimes speak louder than words. Here's a snapshot, and his name is Walt Woods. Now, that argument wasn't made just simply for counts 12 and 14. It's these people are criminals. And that's the same way they used Statler in the quote that I just gave you. It's the same way. Well, they also argued to the jury upcoding. So it's not exclusively substitute belling. Even if it were, the evidence tainted the defense.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Bell.
Sorry, I was running out of time there.
Okay, Mr. Hansen. Good morning.
May I please report? I think the arguments we've heard thus far show how important the word context means. Let's put these in context. First and foremost, I've heard that the government changed its argument on count 12 and 14 because it cited in one of the defendant's briefs that in the response to the motion for new trial, the government wrote down, well, no, count 14 deals with all these other issues. If you read the motion for new trial or the response to the government's response to that motion, and I encourage you to do so, it actually isn't a bad piece of writing, but if you read that, you'll see that we're talking about counts 12 and 13 on the verdict form, not counts 12 and 14 from the jury. If you remember,
there was a renumbering of it.
There was a renumbering of the count 13 was dismissed prior to trial. And so when that was written, it was written, and if you read it, it says counts 12 and 13 deal with substitute billing and Walter Woods. It makes no sense whatsoever if count 13 is dismissed. And later on in that brief, specifically on page, I believe it's on page 14, you'll come, actually I don't know what page it is, 14 sticks out in my mind, so that's the count, but you'll come to the point where we talk specifically count 14 charges of health care fraud, and that's what it was. We were talking about the last count in the indictment. So context is incredibly important in looking at a complicated case like this where there is volumes and volumes of record.
What about the reference in closing argument? Because that was another thing they pointed to.
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Dawson. I'll say it again. If you want two words to show the intent of these defendants, Walt Woods was it. But that's kind of backwards. The Walt Woods argument certainly showed the criminal intent across the board. I don't think we used B.F. Statler or the number evidence, the summary evidence, to do anything regarding counts 12 and 14. I don't think that's reflected in the record at all. And in fact, I think the district court did such a job, a meticulous job, in taking each and every line, each and every word of Deanna Statler, both at trial and in the motion for new trial when it was discovered that what she said wasn't true, and matched that with...
How did that happen?
I'm sorry.
You're talking about putting this whole thing in context.
Context.
How did that happen?
How did it happen?
The light.
Well, if you go through the record, if you see how it progressed, Ms. Statler was asked, as she testified at the trial, to come up with specifically how many billings were there when there was no service, and how many service were there were no billing. And that is in the context of the defense of the ghost billing, if you will, charges. The charges were a billing happened when there was no service to match it,
that was in that context to show that this was not a mistake and it was not an accident. That's what she was asked to do, and that's what it was intended to show. What apparently happened, as I learned later, and as came out at the motion for new trial, is she didn't do exactly what she was asked to do. Why she didn't, I can't answer. It happened. It should have happened. I'm not happy about it. I don't know that anybody is happy about
it. Well, you know, you pointed out in your brief that during the pretrial conference on August the 9th, Ms. DeVore's attorney stated that she thought there were some impermissible records that were included in Statler's data. Once the government is put on notice that some of the data might be incorrect, doesn't the government have a duty to investigate to make sure that it's not putting on false evidence?
And that's exactly what Ms. Pilkington, I believe, was talking about in the modified 20A. That's exactly what she was asked to do again. Take out the hospital codes. Take them out of there. They don't belong there. That's not the question we're asking. And that's what the evidence was presented as, is that was is what we believed it to be, is that without the hospital codes. So, yes, we that was pointed out. We took what I thought was correct measures to do it, unfortunately, the witness testified falsely. I cannot offer an explanation for it other than she did not do what she was asked to do. She could not or did not say she didn't do what she was asked to do, and instead said, I went through this process, and that was wrong. She didn't. That also, however, was corrected by the district court, again, meticulously, count by count, page by page, looking at the evidence, looking at the defenses, and looking at the charts. And can we say that this is patently unreasonable? Can we say that the court abused its discretion in doing that, in saying and counts 12 and 14 are of a completely different character?
Well, the strongest, or a very strong point to you, is that the jury acquitted each defendant on some separate counts.
On different counts.
Which mitigates against this argument that it was just a spillover to everything here.
Absolutely.
But counsel told us about this big screen that was in the courtroom during the trial, and you know how juries focus on that sort of stuff.
Right. The big screen was used throughout the trial. It was used when the exhibits were displayed.
And this whole stream of fraud that was put up there.
I don't believe the screen was the Exhibit 20B. And it was up there during the course of Deanna, the direct examination of Deanna Statler, which, in my recollection, was about 10 minutes worth, in a trial that lasted 4 weeks. Context. If you look at the transcript of Deanna Statler from the course of the trial, it's about 35 pages in about a 2,500-page transcript.
Well, what's your...
context.
I'm sorry. What's your spin? Let me just follow up on the not guilty counts. On the not guilty counts, because counsel says that the individual that testified relating to that count had nothing to do with your problem lying witness.
I'm not sure I understand exactly what counsel was saying about those. I think the not guilty verdicts show, beyond any question, that the jury also looked at the evidence in the case, count by count, bit by bit, witness by witness.
But I think she was saying that the witness that was relied upon for those counts was not, you know, Statler, who had all the problems. So I understand your point that, you know, that meant the jury looked carefully, but she's saying it didn't implicate the perjured witness.
I believe if what the defense is saying is correct, that this witness's testimony was painted so broadly that the defendants could not be believed, that it ruined our credibility, we would have no not guilty verdicts. Now, I disagree entirely with Ms. Pilkington's statements regarding the other evidence. I think the other evidence was compelling. It was overwhelming. It was very, very good evidence on all of the counts.
Dr. Mitrione argues that Section 140.411 of the Illinois Administrative Code allows doctors to bill for service performed by employees under the supervision of a physician, and he interprets that to, that 140.413 regarding psychiatric services not limiting the other section. It's not how I would, read the provision, but isn't it within the realm of possible readings of the code? In other words, should the government be prosecuting people when there is a reasonable, albeit mistaken, interpretation of the law that would make the behavior legal?
I don't believe there is a reasonable interpretation that would make this legal. That section regarding psychiatric, the limitation on services, would be superfluous. It would have no purpose if indeed psychiatrists, like all physicians, could bill for anybody they chose. It would have, as the district court pointed out, it would have no reason to be there. So there are the very reason it's called limitation on services should tell us that there's a limit on services. And then Public Aid went one step further. And I'd like to point this out. The code, or the handbook section that described this regulation was in plain English. This service must be personally, the word personally underscored, must be personally done by a physician. Services by a social worker, psychologist, etc., are not reimbursable. I don't know that they could be clearer as to what the rule, what the regulation was. The question was, is that a proper guideline that the Department of Public Aid can put out? Absolutely it is, because it mirrors the Illinois Administrative Code. I do want to make one point of context here. The defendant Mitrione cites in his brief a Sheen case, and even attaches the Sheen case to say, look, even the Illinois courts have said that this code section, this handbook section, doesn't mean what it says. But the Sheen case doesn't deal with that handbook section. It deals with a section, A210.6, which deals with renal failure. We're talking about A210.7, which deals with psychiatric services. There is a big difference between those two sections, even though they're right next to each other in the handbook. So for that reason, I don't think the Sheen case bears any weight whatsoever with this court. Finally,
let me ask you a question.
Sure.
That's hypothetical, but
yes,
you might not like it anyhow. But you talked about a four-week trial, and no one looks forward to trying a four-week case a second time.
Right.
But if a new trial was ordered here, it would be a streamlined trial on two counts. How long would that take?
I don't think the evidence would be much different. Each of the other counts, strike that, almost all of the other counts have some element of false of substitute billing in them.
404B evidence on all the other stuff?
I think it would go to the scheme to defraud. I think it would still be substantive evidence on the direct evidence on the scheme to defraud.
Okay.
Now, again, context. The government didn't allege three schemes. It alleged one scheme done three ways, perpetrated three ways. So there is that possibility of confusion that we're hearing here, but if you look at what the district court did, there was no confusion there. To try to summarize it in a 20-minute argument or even a 40-page brief is very, very difficult. But after sitting through the four-week trial, after hearing the arguments, after seeing the exhibits, after looking at the legal arguments, the district court was in the best position to make this call. And she made the call correctly, and I do not believe this court can say that she abused her discretion or that no reasonable person could agree with it. If there are no other questions, I'll thank you, and I'll ask the court to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Ms. Pilkington, you have a minute. I'm going to give you a couple.
Your Honor, I have just a very few points to you. First, on the acquittal, if Your Honors will read just page 19 of my reply brief.
I would be very grateful.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Yes, I so that pardon. We'll have a record.
Okay. If you will take a look at page 19 of my reply brief, I set out there, I addressed the issue of the acquittals. On the issue of the government's response, I ask Your Honors, this is a very important case. Please, just look at document 187, look at the government's response. Page 15. This was written long after the trial. Counts were renumbered before the trial started. And what I have quoted to you, I'm reading right out of their response. Counts 1, 12, 13, and 14. I don't think there's any mistake about the numbering. Counsel made a statement to you about that the handbook is very clear. On this, I ask you to read the testimony of Ms. Ronnie Calusa. She was from the Illinois Department of Public Aid. She was the bureau chief. And I went through it with her at some very great length. What the department does, the physician, billing for physician, that's one set of rules. Billing for psychiatrist, that's a different set of rules. The department puts out the physician billing guide. Ms. Colosa, anywhere in there do you say this is not true for psychiatrists? Answer, no. Counsel says it's clear in the handbook. Look at the handbook. It's in the record. It's about this thick. It's a little sentence buried in there. There's a separate section that says for a physician, you can bill for your employees. But no indication. I asked Ms. Colosa, you know, you can put training for these guys online. Has the department thought about doing that? No. So the department does next to nothing to alert a psychiatrist that his rules are different, but at the same time is going to say it's a clear sentence. This is what Mr. Madison was talking about. The laws are so voluminous, I have to go to the Illinois Administrative Code, I've got to go to the handbook, I've got to go here and there. But a psychiatrist, a board-certified addiction psychiatrist who is working with our citizens who are the subject of substance abuse, Dr. Mitchell and Mr. Boer, they're very good practitioners, very good practitioners. They are terrible billers. They're terrible office people. But I ask your owners, based on this record, they would be entitled to a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. And thank you as well, Mr. Hansen. The case will be taken under advisement.